Gary, you have a question?
Yeah, I was wondering, did you say that God is simultaneously sustaining and knowing the universe? I mean, he created it, he's sustaining it, and while he's sustaining, he's knowing.
Well, I can't see that there's a problem with saying that he simultaneously sustains it and knows it, as long as you don't think that that knowledge is separated from the sustaining. I mean, it's not as though God's doing one thing over here, but he's not looking at it, but then simultaneously he holds up a mirror to see what he's doing over here, you know. I want to keep track of how many socks there are in the drawer that I'm sustaining all along. No, I mean, there's unity in the being of God. And But let me come back to the differences between God's thinking and man's thinking. We've already said God's thinking originates things the way they are, and man receives. Secondly, man's thinking is always subject to challenge. God's thoughts never are. They're the criterion, the standard. And there's a sense in which God's thinking, I know this begins to sound like, you know, preaching and piety and devotion. It's hard to give philosophical explanation to it. But there is a quality of wonder to God's thoughts that is not found in man's thoughts at all. And that quality of wonder is not just, he knows so much more than me. That is wondrous. I don't know, if you ever think when you're doing reflection or prayer in the morning and so forth, and you're praising God, think about how much he has to know to keep this universe going. How much he has to know about your own body to keep your body going. And everybody's body and interesting. I mean, his understanding is infinite, as the psalmist says. That's true. But there's something more to the wonder of God's thinking, just that it is so infinite in its extension. And I like to explain it this way, that quality of wonder. When I go out, especially first time out doing a conference with people or in a new church and so forth, it's just one of these social realities. People usually, they treat me very nicely, and there's a lot of deference, if I may put it that way. You know, say, Dr. Boston, you know so much. How did you learn all this? They make complimentary remarks. And I'm not bringing this up to flatter myself. I'm bringing it up to point out something by the difference between humans and God. Now, I say, when I go out the first time, people will often have that sense of distance. They'll say, boy, you are so smart, you know, and you've learned all this stuff, and this is so helpful. Well, if I go back again, then they, hopefully, will still have that respect, but they feel a little chummier with me. And if I go back again, we may even go out and get a hoagie together and talk, you know, and discuss Beatle music and so forth. And as they get to know me more, even when getting to know me more, they respect what I know and what I can teach, there's a sense in which the distance between us is narrowed. Am I right? You probably have all known that. You have professors that you have a lot of respect for, and you don't lose respect for them, but as you get to know more and get to know them more, you don't see the distance between you as great. So as I teach my students, okay, pardon me, Mike, by using an illustration, but let's say if I'm teaching Mike something, and we see each other and I answer his questions and so forth, he's getting to know more of what I know. And the more Mike gets to know of what I know, the sense of wonder and awe, whatever that is, about Dr. Bonson knowing so much, is diminished, right? And this is fascinating to me. The very opposite is true with respect to God. The more we get to know God, and the more information that he has that we get to know, rather than diminishing the sense of wonder and awe, it what? It actually magnifies that sense. There's the very, it's the exact opposite of what we know in our human experience. If you know a lot about electrical circuits, and I think, man, you are so smart, and so forth, then you teach me a little bit of it. I may think you're, you know, smart, but I don't put you on quite a high a pedestal. So one might think, well, the more I get to know about the rose in the garden, electrical circuits, baking a cake, and so forth, that God knows, then God's not so much on a pedestal anymore. But that's not true. And you know that from your own pious experience. You know that from what the Bible teaches as well. The more we know of what God knows, the greater he seems in terms of wonder and awe and distance. He is more exalted as I learn more and more of what he knows. And that's not true in human relations. That's not true of human thinking. So anyway, I could go on and on about this. It should be obvious to us that there's points of sameness between God's knowledge and man's. Particularly, the objects of knowledge are the same. What God knows is the same as what we know. I mean, when we know what God knows. God knows much more than we do. But if God knows the rose and I know the rose, I don't know an analogy of the rose. I know the same thing God does. And if I know a truth, let's just say the truth that God does not lie, that's the same truth God knows. However, there's a qualitative difference between our knowing. God's knowing is original, it's criteriological, beyond challenge, and God's knowing has this sense of wonder to it that can't be replicated in human knowing in relationships.
You were Van Til's editor, and you X'd out that analogical. What would you have inserted in its place?
I think I would have said that man, well, often when Van Til was asked what he means, he said, well, all I'm getting at is that man, to know anything, must think God's thoughts after him. And God's thoughts have a divine quality about them that man's thoughts don't. But what they know is the same thing when they know. And I think that's what I'd put. The problem in choosing the word analogy is not, I mean, literally, difference and sameness, that's fine. But because in the history of philosophy, there's this whole question of knowing the transcendent by means of analogy, that Van Til was confused with Eric Mascall and Thomistic thinking and other sorts of things, which is just not helpful. Would there be one word that I could put in its place? You could ask whether Van Til is using the word analogy that has already has its own history, if you will, purposely using it and infusing it with a different meaning and so forth, in the way that it looks like he's using the word correspondence or coherence. He says we can call it that, but of course we mean something much different than the unbeliever. I have to be honest, I don't get the impression that Van Til was self-consciously choosing a term that's common in epistemological parlance and then saying, but now I'm going to give it a Christian interpretation. I think he chose something to get at the point that God and man are not on the same level. They're not univocal in their knowing. And so the opposite of univocal is analogical. And there's a lot of advantage to it. And in that sense, it was an accident that he picks up something that could be so easily misunderstood. I think it's a fascinating idea, though, that you pose, that maybe Van Til did that on purpose. It just seems to me that if he did it on purpose, it would be the sort of thing after its bad history he would have recognized, and this didn't come off very well. And I never saw Van Til, you know, put it that way. Van Til always thought if people would read what I was saying, they wouldn't draw this conclusion that I meant it in the bad sense. Okay, Mike.
Could you say one more thing about maybe a fourth point in saying that God's thoughts are creaturely, basically not saying much unless you put some meat on it, but to say when God, our thoughts are different from God because our thoughts are creaturely and his are from as a creator, that when he thinks of a rose, he thinks of the rose as the same object, yet he knows the essence of it. He knows how it's, I mean, we can know the empirical, you know, how it's the veins in the rose and the how it undergoes photosynthesis, but he knows how the you know, you could keep on pressing it back, well, how does photosynthesis work, how does, you know, the atoms stay unified, how you could keep on pressing it deeper, and that ultimately God's knowledge of something becomes his knowledge is creatorly, in that when he thinks of something, he can actually not only know how something works exhaustively, but he can bring it into existence as well.
Well, that's part of my first point, that his thinking is the thinking of the creator, so everything that he knows has been originated with him. To use your example, our thinking goes back. Why does this happen? Then we give an explanation. We say, well, then why do those things happen that explain the first thing? And eventually the answer is going to be the Creator made it to be that way. So God knows things all the way back in terms of their essence and function because He made them that way. He's the Creator, and we can never have the Creator's knowledge.
And then you might call this an analytical confusion, but couldn't you say that inherent in God's knowledge is power, that God's knowledge is power in a certain way?
Well, again, I think that's just another way of making the point that when God thinks something, they come into being. When I think something, it could be true, it could be false, and it has nothing to do with whether it's real. But God's thinking makes things the way they are. My thinking is always just receiving information about the way things are. When Van Til speaks of the unbeliever's thought as univocal, he's simply referring to the unbeliever's attempt to wipe out the distinction between absolute and derivative thought. For the unbeliever, there's only one level of intellectual interpretation. Man thinks thoughts that might never have been thought before by God. And God and man are both subject to the same conditions intellectually. When Van Til says we should rather have an analogical understanding of knowledge, Van Til is saying that God and man are not subject to the same epistemological conditions. There is an absolute distinction between original thought, creative thought, and derivative thought. And so Van Til is referring to analogical thinking. When Van Til speaks of analogical thinking, he is not applying this word analogy to terms in our language. He's not talking about whether religious language is figurative, analogical or not. Van Til's not talking about terms, he's talking about a thought process. Human reasoning, the process of human reasoning, is an analogy to God's thinking. We think God's thoughts after Him. That is, we think what God thinks, but we think it as creatures and on a creaturely level. And that is really all Van Til is getting at when he talks about analogical thinking. I had originally thought we would spend a lot more time on this when we get in, or when you now get into the Introduction to Systematic Theology. You'll read about the incomprehensibility of God and what comes down to, or what is involved in the Clark-Van Til controversy. And though we're only in the first syllabus, I wanted to take the time now to give you an idea what that's all about. I think it was a very sad dispute, not only because it disrupted the church, but because Van Til came to be so thoroughly misunderstood, because he said the incomprehensibility of God involves a recognition that we think analogically, not univocally. God's thinking is not just a linear extension of man's. It's not just that he knows more, knows faster, but God's thoughts on a different level. So it's analogical. We think God's thoughts after God as creatures, and in a creaturely way, we think what God the Creator thinks. So we receive His revelation rather than going out and researching and finding out, just like God being on the same level might have to go out and do research as the unbeliever might envision it. Let's go on with the syllabus. Van Til says in the middle of page 203, if men are dead in their sins and trespasses, they are dead epistemologically too, and no demonstration of health will do any good, but only the gift of new life. That's worth pulling out and putting on your wall. Remember that the Bible is not simply talking about emotional, ethical, spiritual death. To be dead in trespasses and sins means to be dead intellectually as well. And only the gift of new life is going to change that deadness. I can do all the demonstration, you know, I want. Imagine I go to the doctor and I happen to have a bad heart. I have a bad aorta. Okay? I go to the doctor and the doctor says, well, I've got this. Let me show you some things. And he brings out charts and pictures and diagrams and medical procedures and surgical instruments and so forth. He goes, And this is how we can fix aortas. I look at that and I say, man, my aorta is working better already. No, it's not. The demonstration of how to fix this aorta doesn't fix the aorta. And this is what Van Til is saying, is we can demonstrate good epistemological health to people, but if the Holy Spirit doesn't give them new life, their hearts are still going to be dead. A further explanation of analogical thought is found on the bottom of page 203. For the sake of time, I'm going to skip over it. Page 204 at the top. Man's knowledge of the facts is then a reinterpretation of God's interpretation. It is this that is meant by saying that man's knowledge is analogical of God's knowledge. I'm going to play prosecuting or defending attorney here. Is that sentence not enough to have corrected the Clarkians in the 1940s? Van Til says, what I mean when I say man's knowledge is analogical is that man's knowledge of the facts is a reinterpretation of God's interpretation. Man takes what God has said and applies it on a creaturely level. He's not talking about a theory of religious language or that we can't know God literally. Okay, the next, two paragraphs down. The point of contact that we may presuppose is that man, as a matter of fact, never exists in such independence as he thinks he does. He remains accessible to God always. Okay, somebody looks at Van Til's system and says, well, according to you, the believer and the unbeliever have two different systems, two different sciences. You could never have any access then to the unbeliever. Van Til says, well, the unbeliever thinks of himself as autonomous, but in fact he's not. And because he's not what he thinks he is, he's always accessible to God. And then just below the middle of the page, we can start with any fact at all and challenge our friends, the enemy, to give us an intelligible interpretation of it. Have you heard that enough times from Dr. Bonson? Are you getting the point? Apologetics can begin anywhere. Not just with miracles, not just with the creator, cosmological argument. You can begin with the taste of coffee. You can begin with what is necessary in our system of social justice. You can begin with mathematics. You can begin with history, literature, anything. And what's our challenge? Make that intelligible. Make sense out of what you know to be true. Since the non-theist is so heartily convinced that univocal, let's just say autonomous, reasoning is the only possible kind of reasoning, we must ask him to reason autonomously for us in order that we may see the consequences. Highlight that. See the consequences. We ask the unbeliever to go ahead and do his autonomous reasoning so we can find out how it turns out. We ask him to show us first what he can do. We may, to be sure, offer to him at once a positive statement of our position, but this he will at once reject as quite out of the question. So we may ask him to give us something better. The reason he gives for rejecting our position is, in the last analysis, that it involves self-contradiction. We see again, as an illustration of this charge, the rejection of the theistic conception that God is absolute, and that he has nevertheless created this world for his glory. This, the non-theist says, is self-contradictory. But the final question is not whether a statement appears to be contradictory. The final question is in which framework or on which view of reality, the Christian or the non-Christian, the law of contradiction can have application to any fact. Let me read that again. The final question is in which framework, that is, within which worldview, can the law of contradiction have any application? When somebody comes to you, see the heart of the argument? It's right here, from the 1930s. It's brilliant. Somebody comes and says, you're being illogical. Van Til doesn't start scurrying around to shore things up to demonstrate to the unbeliever that it's logical. He says, rather, well, within your worldview, why are you concerned about logic? Within your worldview, logic doesn't have any application anyway. the non-Christian rejects the Christian view out of hand as being contradictory. Then, when he is asked to furnish a foundation for the law of contradiction, he can offer nothing but what? The idea of contingency. Unbeliever has shown that my view of the Trinity is contradictory, at least on his understanding. I say, well, I guess within your worldview it might appear that way, but within your worldview, why should anybody be committed to the laws of logic? The laws of logic are what? Universal and unchanging. Just that much is enough. Universal and unchanging. And I asked the individual, what kind of world do you think this is? He goes, well, it's a world that's constantly changing. The only thing that exists are particulars, and they're always changing. Well, but if only particulars exist, and they're constantly changing, then in your world, there aren't any unchanging laws of logic. There are no universals, no principles that you can apply in an unchanging way. What we shall have to do then is to try to reduce our opponent's position to an absurdity. Nothing less will do. And that too is a nice statement of the whole point. What's presuppositional apologetics? Reducing the worldview of the unbeliever to absurdity. There are a lot of ways of doing that. You don't have to do it the way Van Til did with Plato, or the way Dr. Bahnsen tried to do with Dr. Stein. There are a lot of ways. But the project is this. Let the unbeliever explain his view of reality, his view of how we know what we know, his view of human conduct, and reduce it to absurdity. Without God, man is completely lost in every respect, epistemologically as well as morally and religiously. This is the genius of it. We're not just taking a religious message about salvation and the afterlife and trying to tack that on to the theory of knowledge that the unbeliever already has. We're saying you are lost intellectually, too. That your worldview is absurd. It destroys rationality. We must point out to him that upon a theistic basis, our position is not reduced to an absurdity by indicating the logical difficulties involved in the conception of creation. Upon the theistic basis, it must be contended that the human categories are but analogical of God's categories. We think his thoughts after him. We have a revelational epistemology. So that it's to be expected that human thought will not be able to comprehend how God shall be absolute and at the same time create the universe for his glory. If taken on the same level of existence, it is no doubt a self-contradiction to say that a thing is full and at the same time is being filled. But it is exactly this point that is in question, whether God is to be thought of as on the same level with man. So right in the middle of page 205, this is the cream of this syllabus. We must therefore give our opponents better treatment than they give us. We must point out to them that univocal, that is, autonomous reasoning, itself leads to self-contradiction, not only from a theistic point of view, but from a non-theistic point of view as well. It is this that we ought to mean when we say that we must meet our enemy on their own ground. It is this that we ought to mean when we say we reason from the impossibility of the contrary. Van Til doesn't think we're taking one citadel and setting it over against another citadel and saying, from the perspective of my citadel, your citadel is ugly. It can't even stand. Van Til says, we're going to show the unbeliever that on his own terms, his position is reduced to absurdity. That he will provide us the rope by which to hang him. So that he can't get out of this saying, oh yeah, well of course you religious people think I'll be hung on your rope of religion. Van Til says, no, I'll take your epistemology, and given your epistemology, put the noose around your neck, intellectually speaking as well. These are violent metaphors, but you know what he means. This is so important, I think. Van Til says we meet the enemy on his own ground. and show the impossibility of the contrary. So then, when I am defending the faith with an unbeliever or somebody challenging the truthfulness of the Bible, I want to stand on his position, as Vanson would put it. I'll say, okay, well, tell me, what is your view of reality? Where did man come from? You know, is there a God? How do we know what we know? What's reliable? What's not? What are the laws of logic? How does science proceed? What are the moral absolutes by which we should live? Does man have dignity? All these worldview type questions. I'm going to come in your worldview, stand in your house, as it were, and then I'm going to do a demolition work. With the tools you hand me, I'm going to show that your own worldview can't stand. It is this, too, that we should mean when we say that we are arguing ad hominem. Okay? That looks like a logical fallacy. And some ad hominem arguments are fallacious. Okay, if somebody comes to my home and argues that the only way that I can take care of this structural defect, because there are termites, is to use the following chemical procedure and so forth, I should look at the merits of his argument, the facts that are out there and so forth. But if he comes to my home and it turns out that he's, a former communist, and I say, oh, well, you couldn't possibly be right about termites in my house. You were a communist once. That's a blatant ad hominem argument. It's irrelevant to the truth of the termite analysis, whether his political theory was communistic or not. And so ad hominem argument is not per se to be endorsed. But Van Til says, in a sense, we are using an ad hominem argument. We're arguing against the man himself. Here's this man claiming that Jesus Christ is not who he says he is. I say, and you're not who you think you are. Say that again. Person tells me, you claim Jesus is the Son of God. I dispute that. I say, and you claim to know some things. I dispute that. You're not who you think you are. I'm going to be very ad hominem here. Now, the man might say, well, whether I'm who I think I am or not, that doesn't change the merits of the case of whether Jesus is who you say he is. And I say, that's true. And that's what's going to get us into evaluating things in terms of different worldviews, so forth. But my point is that within your worldview, even on your own terms, you're not the man you think you are. I know that sounds like, you know, a macho challenge, but in one sense, that was, you know, if you've been to secular university and philosophy classes, it sometimes comes down to that. You know, you think you know so much, you're so smart, you can put this together. Hey, listen, I'm going to give you an opportunity. Put it together for me. Let's see what you can construct with your autonomous epistemology. Okay, I've been holding you up. Go ahead.
We began by talking about apologetics as evangelism. If we are even successful in exposing the absurdity in somebody's viewpoint and the irrationality of it, if they are people whose hearts are willfully living in an irrational world, what meaning is that going to have to them to confront them with the fact that it is irrational? I mean, they've already been living in that world and enjoying life in that way. How will that bring them across?
Okay.
And I'm a child of the age of testimonials, so forgive me for asking for testimonials, but what I'm really interested in hearing is, in your experience, how you have seen this approach work out in actual dialogue with a person and how that has led them to Christ, or how that has worked in their salvation.
Sure. The first question that you had, I think, is premised, not intentionally, but incorrectly. You suggest they've already lived with this irrational worldview that they've had, and they've become quite accustomed to it, and they're comfortable with it. Wrong. The unbeliever doesn't think his worldview is irrational. Even the irrationalist, this is, we're using irrationality in two different ways, even the irrationalists don't described themselves with the utter chaos and hellish epistemological consequences that we're talking about here. And so the unbelievers become accustomed to his worldview, but what I'm going to put it a different way. The unbeliever has become accustomed to living in God's world, and what he's used to doing is saying, this isn't God's world. And so he thinks he's very comfortable with his atheistic philosophy. And what we have to do is bring him to epistemological self-consciousness and say, now, wait a minute. You have enjoyed the fact that you can make projections about airplanes flying and you can count on human relationships and so forth. You've planned your life. You're a jet setter. You vacation everywhere. And you say there is no God. But if there were no God, airplanes wouldn't work. They wouldn't be reliable. You couldn't know anything. You couldn't count on human relationships to be joyful rather than destructive and so forth. So what the unbeliever has become very comfortable with is living on God's property and then never acknowledging that it's God's property. Or Van Til's common metaphor is what? Borrowed capital. Okay? We're sitting in a home that I think is fairly comfortable. I enjoy my house. I want to stay here. I like this. You know, I like to call it my house. In fact, when people ask me, I say, come over to my house for dinner this Sunday. But those of you who are knowledgeable of finances know that very likely this isn't really Dr. Bonson's house. I'm living on borrowed capital. But you know, I never invite anybody over to my house in this way. I don't say, come on over to the bank's house that I'm living in and we'll have dinner. I just say, come over to my house. And Van Til says that's what the unbeliever does. He's comfortable with calling this his house. What he's comfortable with is the Christian worldview, because that provides for airplanes and human relationships and personal satisfaction. But then he won't admit that it's God's house. So that's why what Van Til is doing here is valuable. And I'll move on to your second question about testimonials to its success.
At that point, you know, you've used the illustration of your discussion with Stein, and you successfully expose the irrationality of his position. Yet, Right. Well, I count anyway, or I Right. Balance my checkbook anyway. And he, in his heart, he will not face up to this irrationality. And even when he is confronted with it, he says, well, I'll live with it because I get along anyway. And I'm not, exactly. I have not been evicted from the house, so I'll just stay here whether it's mine or not.
Yeah, very good illustration. Van Til is not giving us an apologetical tool that will automatically bring evangelistic success. Van Til openly admits, without the work of the Spirit changing the heart. Now somebody might, and I know this is not your intention, but let me put this out there hypothetically. Somebody might say, well, if apologetical argument doesn't bring conversion, then who cares whether your argument's a good one or not? Because God can use bad arguments too. Well, first of all, let's just start at the level of piety and morality. Does any child of God want to say, I'm going to use a bad argument to support my religion? Because God can get by anyway. God can use my bad argument. Well, bad arguments don't glorify God. They're an insult to the one who is the truth. And so if for no other reason, I mean, I have others, but if for no other reason, I'd say, you still have to have the best arguments you can, because we live under God and for his glory. We want to serve him and testify properly to him. But beyond this, if you use a bad argument, you know what you do? You offer the unbeliever a place to run and hide. And that's what makes me so sad. How many times have I seen or heard on tape or on the TV seen a Christian just get, you know, blasted in terms of scholarship, intellectually? You all hurt when you see that too, right? Well, it's not just because I want to glorify God. I do. But I also want to help men. And unbelievers, when they see Christians get blasted in terms of a philosophical argument, you know what they do? It isn't right. But you know what they do? They say, I don't have to think about this. My professor has made an ass out of that Christian in class. That's not even credible. Time is short. I can't study everything. I'm not going to bother to study religion, or I'm not going to bother to study the Christian religion Because I've already seen Christians turn into intellectual fools. And so if we really love the unbeliever and want to be effective in apologetics, we don't want to offer them a way to escape by giving them bad arguments. And this may be just an application of the same thing, but as a third point, I'd say, not only do I not want to make a fool out of myself and give an excuse to the unbeliever to disrespect Christ as the truth, but when all is said and done, if the unbeliever is not going to be converted, I want him to have no intellectual justification for it at all. And if I get an unbeliever, we talked about this earlier, if I get an unbeliever to say, okay, it's irrational, but I'm going to live with it anyway, I've done what apologetics is supposed to do. I've given him only two options, Christ or irrationality. When he says, and of course, I present it that way, and Dr. Stein says, well, you think you've got me in a bind. You know, I've got to become Christian. I've got to become religious now if I'm not going to be irrational. No, I've got another choice. I can be irrational and just repudiate your Christianity. To which my answer is, no, you can think you're being irrational, but you continue to drive your car and to balance your checkbook, and the point is you can give no account of that. When all is said and done, apologetics must be motivated by evangelistic concerns, but I did not mean by that apologetics must be judged by evangelistic success. Although you could judge it by evangelistic success if you take a Calvinistic approach, because I don't believe evangelism should itself be judged just on how many scalps you have, you know, how many conversions. The gospel is also a savior of death unto death. And if I've been faithful, if I've glorified Christ, and that has brought all the more condemnation to someone who is reprobate, I've done my job as an evangelist. But from our human standpoint, and also from the standpoint that God doesn't, you know, take, you know, joy in the death of the sinner, as we're looking for people to be converted, the best thing we can do is to leave them no place to stand. When they have no place to stand, you know what they'll do? If they're perverse, they'll stand on our Christian worldview and claim that they aren't doing so. Borrowed cap. Testimonials, I'm not going to take a lot of time here to go into specific illustrations, but I will tell you that I've had plenty of cases, Dr. Stein, you've already brought up, where I think I've done an adequate job apologetically, and it didn't lead to, from a human standpoint, evangelistic success. The person wasn't converted. Of course, even in the case of Dr. Stein, I don't know that I didn't plant a seed that someone else is going to water and that God might eventually bring him. You know, the day might come, wouldn't this be praiseworthy, that he would write to me and say, years ago I was so stubborn that even when you defeated me, I wouldn't admit it. And I want you to know I've become a Christian and I want to tell you that was wrong and so forth. So we don't know what the outcome is, even when we right now don't see the person crying uncle. But I have seen many people cry uncle. Many people who thought that Christianity wasn't worthy of an intelligent person's consideration. And if nothing else, I really don't like talking about myself this way, but those who evangelize and use this apologetic, if nothing else, they're doing debris clearing. They're pointing out to people that Christianity is not some kind of irrational leap of emotion. That I'm a Christian for intellectual reasons as much as the fact that I don't want to go to hell when I die. And it is valuable. It is practical. I'm not sure exactly what I can tell you apart from telling stories. But often enough, in talking to people who think they have an objection against God, somebody who says, how can you believe in God when there's all this evil and wickedness and violence round about? How could a good God allow all this sort of thing to happen? And then I'll say to him, do you think that's really bad, all that stuff? Child abuse and violence and, you know, and rioting and so forth? Yeah, I think that's horrible. And I'll say, well, but on your worldview, why should that be considered horrible? Just that making them think, oh yeah, I'm talking like a Christian when I condemn rioting and raping and so forth. Why should I condemn them? It's, most people have never been forced to think what's the reason for what they say. Our culture has become so thoughtless that people think, I have a right to a position. You have a right to a position, I have a right to a position. That's all there is to it. And so they'll say, I believe people should be able to do anything they want as long as they don't hurt other people. And they feel very comfortable there. And you have to come along and say, well, why can't you hurt other people? Well, that wouldn't be nice. And say, oh, well, why wouldn't it be nice? Well, you wouldn't like people to do that to you, would you? And I say, well, it's really not relevant whether I want them to do it to me or not. If I do it to other people and I can get away with it, that's fine. Well, that's not very nice. And you're back to, well, what's your standard for things being very nice? The fact that they have a position that doesn't force them to be a rioter or a rapist or whatever makes them think, so I'm okay, I'm not challenged by you, because I'm not going to go out and burn down houses and steal from people and so forth. But our point is, what reason do you have not to? Or what reason do you have to balance your checkbook? If you force people, even if it's not like in an argument where you're getting the person to cry out, you're wrong, admit it, you're wrong. If you just get the person to go home and say, you know, I am being kind of arbitrary here, or there is some contradiction in my thinking, I've got to work this out, I think you've been successful. And what happens is God in His providence picks up on those, you know, open doors and so forth, and a person who finally admits that his thinking is not as rationally self-sufficient as he thought, and is going through marital problems or financial difficulties or having health problems, might just at that point be weakened enough to say, you know, maybe I ought to give some thought to what the Bible says and begin reading it, and the Spirit will use it. Well, I hope that helps somewhat. I'd like to finish this before we stop for lunch, and I know that our lunch will be cool, so let's go quickly. One more question.
Well, in regard to evangelism, would you say also that certainly we have to show them their rationality, but also that the real problem is one of morality and not merely intellectual?
Yes, part of what Van Til has taught us is that the way in which we use our minds is an ethical matter. That when people refuse to subordinate their thinking to God's revelation, they are actually rebelling, ethically rebelling in their mind against God. Or as Paul puts it, that they are enemies in their mind. And we want to point out to the unbeliever that we're not just talking about intellectual parlor games here. Just a matter of who can play the best scholarly chess, after all. That the way in which you use your mind is already an indication of whether you're obedient to God or not. And so there's two things going on. I'm showing that the unbeliever doesn't have the ability to be autonomous. I'm also showing him that he doesn't have the right to be autonomous. And so ethics and epistemology are intertwined. You're exactly right. Top of 206, when we place ourselves upon our opponent's position, we cannot for a moment do more than argue, thus for argument's sake. Van Til doesn't think that the unbeliever has a legitimate foundation. And so let's build a house on his foundation. He says, for argument's sake, I'm going to go into the unbeliever's alleged house and do this demolition work. We've seen that the very question between theist and anti-theist is as to the foundation of the law of contradiction. Very middle of the page. Since the Trinity is the conception by which ultimate unity and diversity is brought into equal ultimacy, it is this conception of the Trinity which makes self-contradiction impossible for God and therefore also impossible for man. Complete self-contradiction is possible only in hell, and hell is itself a self-contradiction because it feeds eternally on the negation of an absolute affirmation. I hope you can understand that. People will actually be in hell, but hell, you see, has to exist because of God, but hell is separation from God. There's a kind of a self-contradiction in the very experience of hell. Yet in order to bring this argument as closely to the non-regenerate consciousness as we may, we must seek to show that the non-theist is self-contradictory upon his own assumptions as well as upon the assumption of the truth of theism. Next paragraph. Now, when this method of reasoning from the impossibility of the contrary is carried out, there is really nothing more to do. On the next page he says, it's the self-sufficiency of the natural man that must be first brought under some pressure before there's any likelihood of his even considering the truth in any serious fashion at all. In a way, I was alluding to that. Van Til says, I've got to show this man that his autonomy will not work, so that that will shut him up long enough to maybe he'll say, oh, maybe I ought to listen to Christianity, you know, because he's just going to dismiss it out of hand. So I show you don't have any platform for your thinking at all, then maybe we can get something of a hearing. He says, the kingdom of God must be built upon the destruction of the enemy. And then one last thing and then lunch. Bottom of 208. If the unbeliever continues to regard Christianity as one hypothesis among many, it is a foregone conclusion that he will not accept this hypothesis rather than another. And if he did accept Christianity as the most likely hypothesis, he would not be accepting Christianity, but a substitute for it. Brilliant insight. When people say, well, Christianity is the best one going, I guess I'll run with it. We have to say, you know what? You're not running with Christianity, if that's what you think of it, as just the best hypothesis available. To reason about anything as a hypothesis for the explanation of any fact or facts means that there may be other hypotheses that should eventually prove to be true. And it apart from God. So our argument is that the falsity of Christianity is inconceivable. Now I know that on first blush the unbeliever would just laugh at that. But this is what it comes down to. Antitheism presupposes theism. And therefore, if someone conceives of Christianity as being false, they've destroyed the possibility of knowing anything at all. In that case, Christianity's falsity is inconceivable. This finishes Dr. Van Til's first classroom syllabus. And we've taken, you know, quite a bit of time on it, and we're going to look at the rest of his apologetical works after we've had our lunch break. But I hope I've accomplished something really important for you, even if we went home right now and did nothing else. You know, the heart of presuppositional apologetics is here, and amazingly, as far as I can see, every major criticism that's ever been brought against this system was already answered in the 1930s. Keep that in mind when you go on to read other works of Van Til, where he doesn't seem to get very deep into things or doesn't take his opponents as seriously as he might, or doesn't write long and extensive answers to this guy and that guy and so forth. Van Til, I think, had the right to say, I've already dealt with that. It's here. And I hope that I've shown you that it's here. But Van Til said, you can't consider it a published manuscript. And so there we have a little bit of an internal critique of Dr. Van Til, whom I love and whose system has taught me so much. It may have been a good idea for Van Til not only to have changed the terminology of analogy, but to have published this as a book, and then he could have just said, go read my first book. Now that you've read his first book, I hope you have the same appreciation for it and for him and his system as I do. Let's eat. Now that you've all had your food, or maybe have had your food, depending on how quickly you eat, I'll be glad to entertain a period of questions and answers before we continue our analysis of Van Til's writings. Anybody, go ahead.
With reference to the issue on analogical...
A little louder, maybe.
With reference to the issue on analogical thinking, on the confusion, is part of the problem not only Van Til's and his lack of clarifying, but as well some of his students and followers misunderstanding of him, or thinking of like Robert Raymond. I think in his book, The Justification of Knowledge, he offers Clark as a corrective to Van Til on that. I think that's his terminology. Is that part of the problem, that people that follow Van Til didn't even understand him as well?
Right. Well, in the case of Raymond, for whom I have affection and respect, the fact is that he was teaching in a denominational school where Clark was a member of that denomination, and that came about... Well, the background of the Clark Van Til controversy, you might expect to be reflected then in the apologetics taught there. And I don't think that many who have an appreciation for Van Til necessarily have done the exegetical work that is necessary to be accurate in portraying his views. And so if you think Clark is a corrective to Van Til, I would take that as an opening symptom or indication that you don't understand what Van Til was getting at in the first place. Because Van Til was trying to correct Clark's leveling everything. And if you want to know how badly Clark's leveling or what kind of consequences were created by Clark's leveling of everything, he ends up translating John 1, in the beginning was the logic, and the logic was God. Well, I don't deny that it's God's thinking that's the foundation of our logic and so forth, but I would still like to maintain the creator-creature distinction, you know, and I think that was a very incautious thing to do. But in one sense, you're not that surprised that Clark would do this if you understood the incomprehensibility debate. So I think Van Til's a corrective to Clark, actually. Mike?
I had a question, this is an exegetical question, in page 208. It was one of the last things you read. You said, if the unbeliever did accept Christianity as the most likely hypothesis, he would not be accepting Christianity but a substitute for it. Now, there's obviously a lot of Christians who have that type of view. They say, yeah, I think Christian is the best going hypothesis, or a lot of them say it's the most probable, or whatever. Now, I mean, I think this could lead to misunderstanding. I like your view on it, but it seems, if you take that literally, he's saying that unless you are a presuppositionalist, you're not a Christian. You have to think that, I mean, even to question Christianity proves that you have you're not a Christian. I mean, the way he makes it sound now.
Let me correct that much. You see, even if you weren't aware of presuppositional apologetics and the challenge to be more consistent in our epistemology and so forth, it seems to me you would still want to say that somebody who accepts Jesus as his Lord hypothetically is not becoming a Christian. Somebody who says, Jesus, I think you're the best game in town, and I'm gonna bet that you're gonna get me through eternity, has not become a Christian. Now, maybe we differ on that, but I don't believe that's conversion. Conversion is when you bow the knee and say, Jesus, you're Lord. And so Van Til is really just applying that point when he says, we don't want people to accept Christianity as the best hypothesis. We want them to accept Christianity as the actual truth and therefore submit to the lordship of Jesus Christ. But he would not for a moment say that if you don't understand consistently your epistemology, that you're not a Christian, nor would he deny the fact of Christian sanctification, that we have days when we doubt and we have to deal with those doubts, sometimes more intellectually, sometimes more morally or in terms of our personal sanctification.
What about when, would you say that a lot of those type of Christians are, you talked about the non-believers being self-deceived. I mean, it seems like they're, there's obviously a different gradation of it, but they're being self-deceived, they're deceiving themselves as well.
Yeah, this is not happy news, but to be realistic, I do think there are some Christians, or some who profess Christ, who are in fact not truly Christians because their understanding of what they've done is, I've found out for myself that Jesus passes all my tests, and I think that he's the one that I want to go with. They pride themselves that they've proven out the claims of Jesus. And only for that reason is he worthy of their respect. Now, I hope that it's not often, and I hope that it's not explicit and self-conscious, but when you have that, you should be very worried that you don't have a heart that is right with the Lord, because in the end, we don't prove Jesus, he proves us. We don't judge him, he judges us.
change the topic, going back to the his view of analogical reasoning. Tim Harris and I had an ongoing debate, and I want your comment on it. You said that when the last point we, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but God's thoughts are creative in the sense that when God thinks of something, it's creative. Now, obviously, it seems like God could think of things without creating them.
That's right.
But Tim's point was that to God, he's not denying it, but he says, I don't understand how there can be a distinction between God thinking something and it not existing, and God thinking of something and it existing. He says, what is the difference between the two? Now, obviously, you come back door and say, well, one thing is out there and the other thing isn't out there. But he says from an epistemological point of view, from God's perspective, that they don't make any difference to God at all.
To be honest, I'm having a hard time deciding how to answer, because I can't believe anybody would say that to God it makes no difference whether he actually created what he was thinking about or whether he just thought about it and didn't create it.
Well, I mean, he wasn't holding, I mean, he was just throwing this out. I mean, it wasn't that he held this type of view. It was, mm-hmm. He says, how do you get out of this type of view? That if God's knowledge of something is exhaustive and it's perfect knowledge, then when God contemplates, what's the difference between God contemplating something? Let me finish it. What's the difference between God contemplating something in its totality and it being there, and God contemplating something in its totality and it's not being there? I mean, the obvious response.
He didn't choose to create one of them.
But if his knowledge is creative of something, you would just need to analyze that and say, well, there's some in ways related, but you've got to flip them off.
Okay, now, it may be that you misinterpreted something that I said. The fact that God's thinking is creative, it has creative power, does not mean that everything God thinks, we're talking anthropomorphically here, that everything that passes through the mind of God, he creates. What I meant is, the things that we know, that we think about, God thinks about as well. The difference is, we think about them receptively, he thought about them creatively. But that doesn't mean that everything God thinks, he creates. Nevertheless, one of the features of God's thinking is its creative, let's say, ability or power, and we don't have that. God knows all possible worlds. But God doesn't choose to instantiate or create all possible worlds, but just this one in which we actually live.
Now, going back to yesterday, you said something like, there's more than one possible world, best of all possible worlds.
Right.
And that God, I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth again, but that God can only contemplate best of all possible worlds.
I don't think I said he could only contemplate the best of worlds. I said he would only create the best of worlds. And then I added that it seems theoretically conceivable there could be a multitude of possible worlds that were equally best.
Well, I mean, the first point, I thought that we had decided against he could contemplate all possible worlds, and because not all worlds were possible, because God limited himself, would only create the best of all possible worlds, and...
Yeah, but God could possibly think about a world that is less than the best. He would never create such a thing, but he could think about it.
But then that wouldn't be the best of all possible thoughts.
No, I think you're confusing something there. What he's thinking about would not be the best, but his thinking about it is not less than best.
It's the best of all way to think about the not best of all possibilities.
Right.
Well, this is not a pedantical point, but it seems kind of an abuse of English language to say there's more than one best of all possible worlds. I mean, within best, it seems to imply this singularity.
Well, if somebody wants to analyze the word best in that way, that's fine. I wouldn't agree with them. I think you can have competing best. But if that's wrong, I'd just say then there's no such thing as the best of all possible worlds. If somebody says, is this the best of all possible worlds? I'd say the concept's meaningless given your definition of best. Okay, somebody else.
We've been talking to the unbeliever and we show them that we get to the point where we present Christianity as that which supplies the preconditions of intelligibility. Should we not be cautious that we're not presenting it as an option, but the option, and presenting it as here's the truth? We want to be cautious that, oh, well, I have something that does make sense. We shouldn't say things like that. We should say things rather, I have the only thing that makes sense.
Yeah, I think the way in which you speak to people so you don't sound arrogant, you don't drive them off, you've got to consider that. But what you're presenting, whatever the dressing or the packaging, what you're presenting is not one hypothesis among many, but the only one that doesn't destroy all predication, science, and logic. And Van Til was getting at that at the very end of our discussion when he said, if somebody accepts Christianity as the best hypothesis, and that's the only sense in which it's accepted, then they haven't accepted Christianity. Yes, you've asked in Van Til's Defense of the Faith, when he lists other materials that people might read who want to follow up, is the order of the reading important, or what I might recommend? My own feeling is, if you're dealing with somebody at the level of the fellows in this seminar, it's not just an introductory level or for a high school student or something. Really, the best bet is to read at least selective chapters out of what we just finished, the Survey of Christian Epistemology. I mean, there is a method to my madness here on how I'm doing the seminar. I'm convinced that the genius of Van Til's thought is right there in the earliest syllabus, and what he does later is essentially elaborate on, explain, and defend what he's already given us. And so I think that's where people ought to begin. Now, if somebody is not inclined to get involved with the more or less philosophical vocabulary right away, I would suggest that the three pamphlets we're going to be looking at this afternoon are where they should begin. And even in the three pamphlets, when Van Til starts going off into the historical survey, you know, and looking at Collingwood and all these others, I would edit that out. I'd say, you don't have to read that. But if you want to get the heart of the system, I'd read these three pamphlets, and then I would go to the Defense of the Faith.
Then, okay.
Or another good place to begin is My Credo, found in his Feshrith, which is a nice, very easy reading, but an organized, distilled presentation of presuppositional apologetics.
So are we going to look at Why I Believe in God?
Yes, it is my hope, since we couldn't get through everything, I made the decision early this morning that what I will do is I'll get through all the apologetics materials so that we at least have one basic aspect of Van Til's writings under our belt by the time we go home this afternoon.
What do you think of those? I'm not sure there was one. There's somebody's written a very thin introduction to Defending the Faith. Have you seen that?
Every Thought Captain?
Well, there's that, Every Thought Captive. That was my question.
Well, Pratt has a book, Every Thought Captive.
Right.
Rush Dooney has a book, By What Standard? Trying to think. Jim Halsey wrote a book, For a Time Such as This. And there are some others as well that are popular introductions to Van Til's thought. And I think that's fine. And I don't wish to disparage any of them. Of those that I've mentioned, Pratt's may be the easiest to get people started with. But even then, Pratt's is not very deep and doesn't go very far in terms of the transcendental challenge and so forth. I honestly think that if you give the right materials to people in the right order, you can read Van Til. And so I probably would just go to that. Or better yet, I understand that there's somebody writing a book on Van Til that will involve readings and analysis and you know, transitions and reorganizing some of the stuff and dealing with critics, and that kind of introductory volume might be the best thing to offer to people. And
who is that person?
When's that coming out? I don't know. I talked to the author about that this morning. He badly wants to get it done. It's all a matter of timing, especially with the study center and other work. But not being so tongue-in-cheek, the reason why I want a book like that is, though you need some help with Van Til, I believe the materials in Van Til read very well themselves, and this approach to patching together various things with explanations, I hope, will accomplish that job. Hope the Lord will bless that.
How are you going to, how are you doing that? Is it going to be sections of his writing? You're going to take, this is his thought on transcendental arguments, this is his thought on common grace or whatever, or is it just going to be mainly apologetical orientation?
Well, it's organized as an introduction to apologetics, where you go through the nature of apologetics, the nature of the unbeliever, epistemological considerations, the argument for God, and so forth. And then what I do is I take selections from various writings and put them under those categories with explanations and transitions.
Now, do you have an introductory piece, or do you annotate it as you go along?
Both. I have an introductory piece, part of which you've heard in the seminar, and then I will put together the various selections from Van Til with annotations and footnotes and so forth.
Okay.